me for presuming upon your property. Gods, I leave you two alone together for 5 minutes and suddenly you're both impossible. Nevertheless, she sat back down in her old chair. The ministrations of the medics had helped with her scratches and bruises, but they could do nothing for the shooting pain in her ankles from landing too hard, or the creeping ache in her shoulders from overusing her motion sorcery. Still, the crowd had cheered for her. Everything had been worth it. Talion walked over to the railing to lean against it, staring into the arena below. Velis caught the source of his staring almost immediately. A woman with brilliant purple plumage rather than hair. Asphodel, she remembered. The Dalaran. Like her description in the files had indicated, she looked young, maybe a few years younger than they were. Unlike most of the files, Asphodel's hadn't given many specifics about her age or background. She had no prior connections with the Paladins of Taos, and the Dalaran were notoriously secretive and xenophobic. Velis hadn't even heard of any Dalaran applying to join the Paladins in the past. If the legends are true, her abilities involve changing her shape, but I don't think she'd bother doing that for a little contest like this. The alterations are supposed to be semi-permanent. It'll be interesting to see what else she could do. The answer to that proved to be remarkably simple. Asphodel closed her eyes each time she knocked an arrow, and each time the arrow hit perfectly on target. By the end of the first round, her target had two arrows where its eyes should have been. 6 more were in the neck and another 2 in the shoulders, and the remainder had been used to break the barrier. She's even more accurate than Landon or that Terrace girl. Air sorcery when she closes her eyes, maybe? It wouldn't be impossible. 2 more rounds of 12 arrows left Asphodel's target thoroughly torn apart. No other applicants in her round showed similar promise. The next round, however, was far more intriguing. On the far left side of the group was Jonathan Sterling, the bright-haired Haven Knight. He still wore a dueling sword on his left hip. As he approached his shooting position, he scanned the crowd. Velis thought his gaze slowed for a moment when it passed over her, but she couldn't be certain. Toward the middle of the group was Susan Crimson, the former Thorn Guard from Sullier. Given Bertram's performance, Velis didn't have particularly high expectations for Susan, but the House Crimson woman was wearing a belt with a pair of throwing knives and 6 small pouches. That offered her some options. Sterling's first round of arrows was accurate but uninspiring. His archery skills seemed similar to Landon's, with several hits landing on target, but without any sorcery to augment the strikes, he only managed to pierce the target 2. One of those hits was to the neck, however, which Velis judged to be likely to count as a kill. Crimson removed her 1st arrow from her quiver before lifting her bow, reaching into a pouch and retrieving a vial. She unstoppered the vial, pouring a few drops on the tip of the arrow, and then replaced the cap.
Poison? Really? In a competition to join a paladin order?
Velis shook her head, continuing to watch. Crimson's 1st arrow flew true, and never encountered a barrier. It sunk directly into the target's face. There was a brief murmur from the crowd. Susan grinned, applied a few drops to the next arrow, and repeated the process. Of her 12 arrows, 7 hit the target, and none of them suffered any interference from the sorceress shield. After a paladin visibly checked the target and renewed the barrier, the crowd watched in anticipation for her next volley. She didn't apply the liquid this time, and the barrier stopped her 4 arrows.
"That's a very, very dangerous trick. I'm going to need to figure out how to copy it."
Sterling put another 2 arrows in his target, but Velis barely noticed. Susan had all her attention now.
What's she keeping in those other pouches? How many interesting tricks does she have?
The House Crimson woman didn't open any of her other pouches in the final round, nor did she throw her throwing daggers. Throwing daggers that distance would be difficult, but not as hard as throwing a sword, and she had been somewhat hoping that Crimson would try it. Nevertheless, as she watched the young woman leave the arena, Velis raised a hand to her lips.
"I'm going to have to keep 2 eyes on that one."
Other rounds came and went, with none offering the spectacle that the 1st few had. Velis suspected that the local candidates were deliberately sorted into the 1st 4 rounds, most likely to give them a better chance at higher scores. She suspected the judges would get progressively harsher with later candidates. Of course, she considered the possibility of the opposite. Later applicants would have the chance to observe the earlier rounds and learn any tricks that others used. That advantage diminished rapidly after the first few rounds, however, and she suspected the judges would be more lenient with people they were already familiar with. Only two contestants were disqualified outright, one for running across the line early, and the second for damaging his dummy deliberately while he was retrieving his arrows. One candidate doused his target in alcohol while retrieving his arrows, which was allowed, apparently, and then set one of his arrows on fire and succeeded in setting his target ablaze. By the time of the final round, the audience seemed to have lost most of its enthusiasm. Resetting the targets for each contest was a time-consuming process, and the Dawnfire was quickly retreating from the horizon. As the last group approached, Velis only recognized one person among them, the monstrously tall man who called himself the Wandering War. He was still wearing his hood and cloak, which Velis was starting to suspect was more than just pretentiousness.
"If those documents are accurate, he's not human, and probably not Rethri either. Asharan, maybe? Would the Paladins allow an Asharan candidate?"
"And open fire!"
Velis watched as the Wandering War lifted his bow, drawing back the string. An aura of orange light formed at the arrowhead, twisting and swirling as it grew. He released the arrow. The streak of orange flashed forward across the arena, ripping not only through the barrier, but all the way through the target. It continued to fly until reaching the outer wall of the arena, smashing into the stone and triggering a flicker of blue and orange sparks, the marks of the arrow striking a powerful defensive spell on the arena itself. The hole in the center of the straw man was larger than Velis's fist and irregular in shape, like a massive screw had been drilled into the dummy's chest. As the other archers finished firing their arrows, the Wandering War raised his hands, and each and every arrow tore free from the other targets, soaring through the air toward his. His own 11 arrows rose, seemingly of their own volition, and joined other arrows in flight, burying themselves in the dummy. Fallen arrows that had missed their targets initially rose again, each striking the Wandering War's target from another angle. When the round ended, all 300 arrows had pierced the Wandering War's target. The audience sat in silence. Chapter 8. Talion 2. Probable Suicide. Talion stood at parade rest in the second row of paladin candidates. His position in the group had been determined based on his arrival time at the meeting grounds, not on any sort of merit. Velis was positioned to his right and Landon to his left, since the three of them had arrived together. With great effort, Talion restrained himself from making any nervous movements. The meeting ground was a grassless, oval field, large enough to fit hundreds of people. Talion had been there twice before to observe large-scale tactical exercises, but he had never participated in any activities there himself. Most rows consisted of 12 candidates, and there were two rows behind Talion. Oddly, the final row had a 13th member. The candidates had stood in their positions for several minutes while a group of three paladins, some of whom Talion had seen, but none of whom he precisely recognized, spoke several yards in front of them. Eventually, the discussions ceased, and the three paladins turned to face their audience.
"Three rows of 12 and one row of 13 makes 49 of us, which is 9 more than the number that passed the preliminary exams. Some candidates that skipped the prelims somehow are possible, but it's also possible that there are some full paladins in here with us as plants to observe our behavior."
Two of the paladins were wearing a dress uniform in the colors of their order. The paladin on the left was male, looking to be in his 30s, and wore the green and brown of Lissari. The emblems on his tunic indicated that he was a lieutenant. The two other paladins were female. At the center was a woman who had a young face, but more gray than brown in her hair. Her immaculate dark blue uniform was accented with silver, indicating that she served Cytira, much like Lydia did. Her eyes swept across the candidates, searching, but she gave no obvious tell if she found who or what she was looking for. The addition of two bars and a triangular emblem above pins similar to the lieutenant's indicated that she was a full colonel, a considerably higher rank than Talion had expected to observe the instruction of mere cadets. On the right was another woman, the tallest of the three paladins, wearing full armor and a steel-gray tabard with the symbol of Coronir emblazoned on the front. Unlike the other two paladins, the Coronir follower took a stance of rigid attention. Her tabard had no symbols of rank, indicating that she was either a rank-and-file paladin or had some reason she preferred not to show her rank.
"At ease," spoke the woman in the center. One of the candidates to Talion's left took an audible breath of relief as the group adjusted into more relaxed positions, but remained in their formation. The speaker's eyes shifted, seeming to note the lapse, but she made no comment on it. Talion noted, as he adjusted his own stance, that the paladin of Coronir remained at attention, even while the candidates did not. He wasn't clear if that was normal behavior.
"I am Colonel Windham, and I will be overseeing your tests. Lieutenant Morris will explain the structure of your examinations."
She gestured to the man at her side, and he nodded and stepped forward.
"For the next 3 months you will be tested. You will not always be aware of when you are participating in a test. There are 7 primary tests that you will participate in during this time period, each of which corresponds to one of our guards. If at any time your score on one of these tests falls below the acceptable threshold, you will be disqualified from the examinations. If at any time your cumulative score falls below the acceptable threshold, you will also be disqualified. If you are discovered attempting to cheat in the examinations in any way, you will be disqualified and lose any opportunity to retake the examinations in the future."
Lieutenant Morris paused, examining the crowd, and then spoke again.
"If your performance on a test is unsatisfactory but not low enough to disqualify you completely, you will be issued a red flag. If you are issued 2 red flags, you will be disqualified. Most candidates that are issued even a single red flag will not have a high enough cumulative score to complete the examination process."
The lieutenant took a breath and then continued.
"During the course of the examinations, each of you will be assigned to a barracks. An experienced paladin will be overseeing each of the barracks to ensure proper conduct. You will be assigned a uniform, which you will be required to properly maintain and wear for your examinations. You will also be assigned other tasks and responsibilities during the testing time frame. Failure to complete these tasks or demonstrate proper conduct will result in being disqualified from the examinations. There are 49 of you now. Tradition dictates that of the 49 candidates that begin the tests, only 7 among you will be selected to join the Paladins of Taos during this test. The arbiter of each branch of paladins will be presented with results of each test and personally select 1 applicant to honor with a chance to join our order. Those of you who perform well, but are not selected, will be given a chance to skip the preliminary examinations in future years. A schedule of examinations will be posted in your barracks. You will arrive in uniform and on time for each of your examinations, or you will be disqualified. Second Lieutenant Banks will take each of your groups to your new barracks. First row, attention!"
The first row of cadets snapped to attention, although some handled the transition more smoothly than others. Talion noted that Keldon Andis was in the first group, along with the Rethri twins, Terras and Lysen. Next to them was the tall man in the billowing cloak who called himself the Wandering War. Susan Crimson was in the first group as well, but a few people separated her from the others that he recognized. The Paladin of Coronir wordlessly stepped forward and then gestured with a hand.
"First platoon, follow me."
She unceremoniously turned around and began to walk, not waiting for the cadets to respond. They quickly turned and followed her. Talion let his mind wander as the group stood waiting for Second Lieutenant Banks to return. The colonel had turned back to conversation with Lieutenant Morris, and many of the candidates near him seemed to be getting nervous. Velis glanced toward him and raised her eyebrows, but he just gave her a slight shrug, uncertain what she was asking.
"Maybe she's wondering if we're at a disadvantage for being in the second group? Possible, I suppose, but I doubt it. Have the tests already started? What Colonel Windham said was pretty vague."
A quarter of an hour later, Lieutenant Banks returned and ordered Talion's group to fall in behind her. They dutifully did so, and Talion suspected they felt just as grateful to finally be moving as he did. The walk to the barracks wasn't far. A uniformed paladin, this one wearing the light gray and blue of Eritar, leaned lazily against the wall next to the barracks door. A rapier and a main gauche sat sheathed against his hips. their brilliantly polished steel pommels standing as a contrast to the obvious creases in his uniform.
"Platoon 2, halt!"
Lieutenant Banks called, and Talion's group ceased their march and fell into resting at attention.
"You could at least try to look professional for the cadets, Lieutenant Torrent."
The paladin at the door gave an unapologetic shrug and a slight smile.
"I keep telling you, call me Garrick. So, I take it these are my new puppies?"
Banks's lips twitched.
"This is Platoon 2. If they are not properly prepared, I am holding you personally responsible."
With that, she briskly turned 90 degrees to the right and marched off. Lieutenant Torrent shook his head at her as she departed and then stepped away from the wall.
"Welcome," he said, gesturing broadly with both hands. "You kids are the lucky ones. You get to work for me."
In spite of the use of the term kids, Talion suspected that Garrick was at least a year or two his junior.
And a fan of theatrics. I shouldn't be surprised, given which branch he belongs to.
"Be at ease. I'm going to take you for a tour of our lovely new home," he said, gesturing to the door.
As the candidates fell out of their marching formation, Garrick turned around and opened the door, stepping into the barracks. The candidates followed him shortly thereafter. Talion had lived in other barracks before, during his training under the Thorn Guard, and this one was little different. There were 6 sets of bunk beds, each with 2 large trunks stacked in front of them. It struck him for the first time that there were a mixture of men and women in his platoon. They had been separated during his earlier training. He realized that might have been because of differences between the paladins and the Thorn Guard, or it might have just been because he had been so much younger the last time he had gone through similar training. Also, unlike the other barracks he was familiar with, this one had 2 doors toward the back. Garrick was already walking toward the one on the left.
"This is my room. I'm a fairly sound sleeper. If you wake me up and the barracks isn't on fire, I'll disqualify you immediately,"
he informed the group cheerfully.
"First hint of an edge I've seen to him," Talion considered. "Guess he might not be quite as much of a pushover as he sounded like initially."
"Oh, and with that in mind, pick any beds you want. You each get a trunk. Once we issue your uniforms, you'll be responsible for keeping those in your trunks when they're not being used and keeping them in good condition. If you don't, well, disqualified."
He walked over to the second door at the back, knocking on the door.
"Chamber pot is in here. Remember to knock."
He folded his arms, glancing from side to side.
"For the next several weeks, assuming you puppies last that long, your first obligation is to each other. Sure, you'll have individual test scores, but platoon averages will hit all of you. I'm happy to disqualify you one at a time, but when we get to the team tests, you're going to want as many friends as you can get."
A moment of silence followed as the candidates looked each other over, most bearing grim expressions.
"Questions? Didn't think so. Find yourself a bed. Get to know each other."
Garrick immediately turned and retreated into his own quarters, leaving the second platoon standing around awkwardly by themselves. Landon immediately sat down on one of the beds closest to the entrance, and thus furthest from the lieutenant.
"You heard the man. We wake him up, we're done."
"Yup."
Velis brushed past Talion and grabbed onto the ladder connected to the bunk bed that Landon was sitting on, hoisting herself up onto the top bunk. She sat with her boots hanging over the side, looking down.
"Better find yourself a bunk quick, Sal. Hope you get a good bunkmate."
She gave him an overly obvious wink, and Talion just sighed and shook his head.
"Great. I don't really know anyone else here."
The other local paladin candidates had ended up in other platoons. He glanced around at the other candidates, who were quickly following Landon's lead and taking beds as close to the entrance as possible. The lone Rethri candidate in his group looked marginally familiar, so Talion approached him first, extending his hand in greeting.
"I'm Solaris. Is the other bunk here taken?"
The Rethri hesitated for a moment before clasping him on the wrist, turning his gaze away.
"Eridus. Sorry, bed's taken."
The swordsman nodded as Eridus swiftly retracted his hand.
"No problem. You look a little familiar. You from Sullier or thereabouts?
No, sorry. Don't think I know you.
Eridus took a step back, waving a hand toward the other beds.
Better get one of those before they disappear.
Right. Thanks anyway. Pleasure to meet you.
Wonder why he looks so familiar. Blue eyes, which makes him a water sorcerer, I think. Maybe he's one of Aladir's friends or relatives. There are so many Tetherials, it's hard to keep track of them all.
By the time Talion glanced around again, there were only two beds left, and a group of three people standing near the back and discussing them. Two of the three looked relatively ordinary, a male and a female that looked a few years younger than Talion, each wearing matching leather armor and a pair of curved short swords. The matching swords and armor might have made Talion suspect they were related, but they didn't share any obvious physical characteristics. The girl was a few inches taller than her male counterpart, and she had short, wavy black hair and matching dark eyes. The male was brown-skinned and shaved bald, with broad shoulders and thick biceps. And standing in a sheltered position between the pair was a girl with a cascade of shimmering crystalline strands, each about the width of a finger that reached from her head down to her knees. She wore a simple gray tunic and pants and observed the other candidates with eyes wide with curiosity. Talion approached the group, reaching out to extend a hand to the closer of the two armored figures.
"Stop!"
the armored female said.
"Do not come so close to the Oracle."
Her eyes shifted to Talion's sword, narrowing.
"You are armed."
Oracle? That's an odd title. And why would a Dalaran need bodyguards? And human ones, no less. Talion carefully took a step back, lifting his open hands.
"Sure am. Looks like you're pretty well equipped, too. I don't mean any harm. The name is Solaris."
"I am Asphodel,"
the Dalaran girl said, stepping toward him and extending a thin hand as her guards looked on with horrified expressions. Talion reached out with his own hand, clasping hers at the wrist.
"Her skin is cold," he realized.
He gave her a warm smile. "Pleasure to meet you. I'll look forward to working with all three of you." He released her wrist, and she smiled brightly in reply.
"Thank you. Please forgive my friends. They are unaccustomed to being so close to so many people."
"Oracle," the male guard said, "you should remember what your father told you. You expose yourself to danger when you are within weapon reach of a stranger."
Asphodel turned around, which Talion absently noted had actually made her more vulnerable. A deliberate gesture? And stepped back behind the two guards.
"You two are Asphodel's guards, I take it? You've got nothing to worry about from me. I can't stand hurting people."
"You should not refer to the Oracle in such a familiar fashion,"
the female guard said.
"You are merely a human."
"And your words are suspect. One with such disdain for harm would have little motivation to join a military organization,"
the male pointed out. Talion raised an eyebrow. "You know the paladins of Taos emphasize protecting life at all costs, right? That's one of the core tenets of the religion." The guards looked at each other uncertainly.
"Words such as those are little solace to the dead, one called Solaris,"
the female guard said.
"Well, that was remarkably foreboding and vague."
"Well, your skepticism about my motives aside, we've got two beds left here. We're going to have to split them up."
"We were just discussing that,"
Asphodel explained, folding her hands behind her back and looking at the floor.
"Would you share your bunk with me?"
"Sure. You want the top or the bottom bed?"
The male guard took a step toward Talion and then turned toward Asphodel.
"Oracle, I must insist. You should not be so close to an outsider. He is not..."
"He is the Talion. I would wish to know him better."
She stepped over to the last bed on the left, the closest to Garrick's door, and sat down on it.
"I will take the bottom."
Talion.
He hadn't mentioned that name, but he was wearing the Sekhess on his hip.
Did she hear that I used to go by that name from someone? Or is she just associating the name with the sword in the way some of the people back home did?
"Sounds good," Talion turned to the guards. "We're going to be working closely with one another. Do you mind if I ask your names?"
"Tishvol,"
the man said, not extending his hand.
"Kolask."
The female guard hesitated for a moment, then glanced at Asphodel, and finally offered Talion her hand. He grasped her wrist and gave her a firm nod before releasing it.
"Thank you,"
Talion replied.
"If you harm her,
Teshwal began.
Teshwal, that is enough,
Aswadel commanded. He lowered his head and fell silent.
Talion, we will have much to discuss.
Talion turned to Aswadel and raised an eyebrow. Such as?
That,
she said,
will best be discussed in private.
Talion arrived at his assigned testing area 10 minutes early, stopping at the door to the 3-story training facility. The building had several rooms on each floor, and during the rest of the year, each room was assigned to a specific form of practice. While the outdoor training grounds were more commonly used for direct combat training, the indoor facilities were specifically equipped for handling sorcery training and specific forms of armed combat. Since the tests had started, the entire building had been made off-limits to recruits. He assumed that meant that the rooms inside were being repurposed for the specific tests they would be undergoing. And when he had been handed his testing schedule, that hypothesis had quickly been validated. Nervously, he adjusted his uniform, attempting to ensure everything was immaculate. Fortunately, the candidates had been allowed to wear their own weapons of choice. He would have felt naked without the Sekhess on his hip. He had not let it escape his sight since his battle with Myros in the arena in Orlan, more than 8 months before. He snapped to attention as the door opened. A uniformed paladin of Cytira exited the training structure, and Talion delivered an immediate salute. The paladin was a stocky blonde man with a wicked flanged mace hanging from a cord on his left side. The cord seemed to be looped directly through the pommel of the mace, which looked impractical. Some kind of trick knot that he could quickly pull free to ready the weapon? After a moment, he shook his thoughts free. Can't think about that right now. Focus on the test. The paladin glanced Talion over for a moment, and then returned his salute.
At ease.
Talion nodded and shifted his stance. Sir?
You're Cadet Solaris, I take it?
Yes, sir. The paladin frowned.
I was picturing someone taller.
Talion barely resisted the urge to note that the paladin was at least half a head shorter than he was. He had an odd scar that ran diagonally across his nose, hooking around to meet the right side of his lips. Sorry if I've disappointed you, sir. The paladin made a dismissive gesture.
Nothing to worry about. And Lieutenant Trace, I'll be explaining the details of your first test.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. The paladin paused, glancing at the Sekhess and then looking up to meet Talion's gaze for just a moment before turning away.
Right. So this first test will be a simulation. You will be taking on the role of a paladin serving as an advisor to an influential military leader during a major battle. For the sake of this scenario, assume that you are a newly assigned paladin lieutenant and that no higher-ranking paladins were available to provide support. For the sake of convenience, you may use your real name. Every person you encounter will be playing a simulated role. If you encounter anyone you recognize, treat them as a stranger and in accordance to their simulated role. For example, if you recognize an actual paladin officer playing the role of a servant, ignore his or her actual rank for the purposes of the scenario. Instead, act upon the information that you can glean from the setting of the scenario itself.
Talion nodded. During his training under the Thorn Guard, he had participated in other types of simulations. While he had never taken on the role of a military advisor, he had observed similar tests and studied several texts on historical battles. He wasn't precisely relieved by the scenario, but it certainly could have been far worse.
The scenario you will be participating in is a high-stakes battle, and it will require careful judgment on your part. Are you prepared?
May I ask you questions about the scenario in advance, sir? The paladin shook his head.
It will be your responsibility to ascertain the details of the situation when you arrive. You may safely assume that the military leaders have requested an advisor from the Paladins of Taos, and that you are the advisor that was sent. Your orders are to provide any and all assistance you can to the military leaders.
Understood, sir. In that case, I am ready.
Very well. Remember, once you step inside that room, treat everything in the simulation as if it is your new reality.
Lieutenant Trace opened the door to the room.
You may step inside and begin the test.
Upon entering the room, Talion's path was immediately barred by a pair of oddly dressed soldiers. As they maneuvered their halberds to block his path, Talion scanned their white and red uniforms for anything he could recognize.
An antiquated style, and I don't recognize most of the symbology. I think that pin might be an older version of Coronier's shield, but I'm not sure.
He took a stance of attention, raising his right arm to his chest in a paladin salute. "Paladin Lieutenant Solaris, reporting as requested," he droned, examining the situation beyond the two soldiers as he spoke. The room was at least 30 feet across, and toward the center, three uniformed officers stood around a table. Laid out across the table was a map, and atop the map were numerous different figures,
about as traditional of a depiction of a war room as I've ever seen.
"Come in," said one of the men around the table, making a dismissive wave at the guards.
The two soldiers retracted their pole arms, giving a brief salute to the speaker before taking a restful stance. Talion lowered his salute, advancing toward the table and pausing a few feet away.
"Hello, I'm Paladin—"
"Yes, yes, we heard," said a clean-cut older man at the opposite side of the table.
His uniform was the most decorated of the three people standing around it, with dozens of pins and sigils that Talion didn't quite recognize. Fortunately, he did recognize the four bars on the right side signifying a specific military ranking, a lieutenant general. This man was presumably the army's leader.
It took Talion a moment of paralyzing shock to recover from the realization that the man standing in front of him was Harrod, the retired paladin who had been observing his training.
He looks impressive like this. The uniform fits him far better than civilian garb ever did.
"There's no need to be rude, Revelin. We did send for an advisor,"
spoke the lone female officer at the table, an older woman with bright white hair. She wore a pair of short swords on each of her hips, a choice that Talion approved of. If he hadn't spent most of his career training with the Sekhes, he might have preferred a similar style.
"You sent for the advisor," Revelin sighed. "But he's here, so I suppose we should let the boy tell us how we're waging war all wrong."
The lieutenant general waved at the map.
"Please enlighten us, servant of the gods."
Talion glanced over the table, noting soldiers in several different colors on the map. There were several types of pieces representing soldiers, and fortunately, Talion had seen similar ones used in other war games in the past. He quickly recognized spearmen, swordsmen, archer, catapult, and commander pieces. There were, however, three types of pieces he did not recognize. There was a city near the center, and black markers for soldiers all throughout. Outside the walls, there were a larger number of white pieces and red pieces. Some of the red pieces were interspersed among the white ones. Others were separated into smaller units. The black pieces inside the walls of the city were almost exclusively archers and catapults. The majority of the city did not have any pieces within, which implied that the Black Force's swordsmen, spearmen, and other pieces were most likely still within the walls and that they did not have enough information on their locations and numbers. This, in turn, meant that the white and red forces were most likely his forces, and the ones attacking the city. The white and red uniforms matched that hypothesis nicely.
That's not good at all. Being the attacker in a scenario with an unknown number of enemy forces inside a city is a terrible situation.
Glancing at the white and red pieces, Talion estimated at least 100 of them. The archers on the inside were far fewer, at least, only about 20 pieces. Each side had four visible catapults. He assumed each piece represented either 10 or 100 troops, but he wasn't sure of which, and it clearly would make a significant difference. "I'm afraid my briefing on the situation was, well, brief, if you'll excuse the pun," Talion chuckled, but no one else laughed. "Can you clarify for me how many troops each of these represents?" He pointed at one of the red spearmen.
100 of our best," the third officer said. "The Ember Legion has never been defeated in battle."
Ember Legion? I've heard that name before.
"We're being quite rude to the poor boy."
The female officer extended a hand toward Talion. Realizing that they appeared to be simulating some sort of older siege, Talion took her hand and shook it, rather than clasping her wrist in a modern fashion. She smiled.
"Lieutenant, I'm Colonel Morningway. This is Colonel Laurent,"
she said, releasing Talion's hand to point at the last officer who had spoken.
"And our leader, Lieutenant General Revelin."
"A pleasure to meet all of you," Talion exchanged handshakes with the other two men. "You'll have to forgive my questions. I would prefer to have as much context as possible before offering any advice."
Of course,
Laurent replied. Revelin simply sighed again.
So, 100 troops per piece. That means we have roughly 10,000 troops total. I'm sure the commander pieces don't represent 100 commanders, but even accounting for that, we have a lot of troops. We clearly appear to outnumber the enemy, but even just their archers represent about a fifth of our numbers. That's 4 times our number of archers, implying that if the ratio is maintained, they have 4 times our number of troops. Fortunately, they probably don't have quite that same ratio. As defenders, they probably gave bows to as many people as possible, possibly depriving them of other forces. Hard to know for certain.
Just having walls gives the defenders a tremendous advantage. Talion quickly scanned across the map, noting 2 water sources flowing into the city walls. Controlling those points would be important. Water was not only necessary for the people inside to survive, it was also a potential method for infiltration, or for the enemy to send troops out, depending on who controlled it.
I fear I don't recognize all these types of pieces. I see spears, swords, bows, catapults, and commanding officers, which I'm familiar with. I'm not certain what this one, he pointed at a piece, or these 2 types of pieces represent.
Those, Laurent pointed to a unit of unique red pieces, are my pride and joy.
Sorcerers, Morningway clarified.
Laurent scoffed.
The Cinders are no mere sorcerers. Once you see what they can do...
Cinders appears to be a division name within this Ember Legion. I know I've heard those names.
He scratched at his chin.
Weren't those the war sorcerers who died during the siege of... Oh. Am I fighting the final battle against the Zixian Empire?
The fall of Zixis was legendary, but details were scarce. The capital city of the Asharan had withstood numerous assaults throughout the millennia of its existence, with most invading armies unceremoniously crushed. While Zixis did eventually fall, the circumstances behind the final battle were known to few, mostly because so few survived it. Something so terrible had happened there that Zixis was no longer even drawn on maps. Some claim that Vyrek Sul, the final emperor, had cast a ritual that had immolated the entire city and burned most of the invading army alive. Others spoke of a plague that spread through the survivors, claiming their lives before they could return home in victory. Still others claimed that the desperate Zixian sorcerers had discovered a way to force the dead to stand and fight again, controlling both former friends and foes like deadly puppets, forcing friends to cut their former comrades apart to keep them from rising again.
This could be one interpretation of how the battle may have been waged, Talion realized. There are books detailing how many troops were sent to the battle, an analysis of the claims of the survivors. I even read a few of them back when I was in my early days of training. A shame that was so long ago. Those details might have been useful.
The Cinders have a reputation that precedes them, Colonel Morningway. I'm certain they will be instrumental in our success, Talion offered respectfully. It was not a mere platitude. He suspected that the sorcerers would be necessary to offer any form of fighting chance against the capital city of Zixis. Laurent grinned in reply.
Glad someone around here takes my men seriously.
What are these other figures? Talion pointed at the other 2 types he had failed to identify.
These first ones are infiltrators. I'm not surprised a paladin wouldn't be familiar with them.
Revelin folded his arms.
A light jab, but one intended to make it clear he doesn't have much respect for my organization. I'm probably not supposed to stand for the paladins being insulted, I suppose. Either that or I'm supposed to grin and bear it since he outranks me and I want to influence him. Not sure on which.
On the contrary, General, we make judicious use of scouts and infiltrators. We simply do not give them different pieces on our war maps, because our enemies tend to use them too. Herod flushed, gritting his teeth.
Of course.
That might have been a poor move, but it felt great.
And the final pieces?
Anything not covered by the other categories.
Morningway pointed at one of the white pieces close to the back of the army.
These ones here represent medics, for example. Others represent messengers, squires, and other miscellaneous support troops.
Talion nodded.
That takes about 800 troops out of my calculations, since these would not be direct combatants.
Excellent. Thank you for the clarifications. I assume the grid squares on the map represent 1 kilometer?
Yes.
Morningway picked up an archer piece that was near the front lines.
meaning our forward troops are currently outside of the range of their archers and just approaching the range of their siege.
And I assume they are aware of us already? Talion folded his arms, squinting at the organization of the troops. He already saw elements he wanted to reorganize. Spearmen that needed to be moved in front of swords. Archers that were uselessly out of range, and sorcerers with no protection. But he suspected those issues were less important than the basics of the first engagement.
Yes. We sent a messenger ahead with our demands days ago. He never returned, of course. We've spent the intervening time taking positions and evaluating their movements. We currently plan to engage at nightfall.
Morningway walked over to a stack of soldiers that were off the board.
These additional troops represent reinforcements we are expecting from Valeria. They should arrive within a few days. We were expecting them by now, but we no longer feel we can wait. Even a few more days could cost the prince his life.
Prince? What's this now? I probably should already know this, and I've already been asking a lot of questions. Maybe I should try to figure this out on my own. I would advise against attacking at nightfall, Talion offered.
Oh? And why is that?
Revelin leaned across the table, looking unamused. Talion felt his lip twitch when the larger man knocked over a soldier piece with his movement. Harrod sure does a good job of pretending to be an asshole. I hope he wasn't actually like this when he was a paladin officer. Infiltration at night might offer some slim benefits, but the Asharan have better night vision than we do. Their archers will be better shot at night. The old general rolled his eyes.
Of course they will. We're not idiots, boy. We're going to open up with sorcerers and burn their siege. Once we do that, we can start pounding their walls from a distance without opposition.
Talion scratched at his chin. Not a bad idea, actually. At least on the surface. Am I supposed to find flaws in that plan? We'd be playing our best hand early, Talion hazarded. It's a sound plan, but we'd have to be prepared for the consequences. Any Asharan that are directly exposed to the bombardment will adapt to it. At this distance, our sorcerers won't have any degree of precision. They might destroy the siege engines, but the enemy troops will barely be touched. And if the Asharan withdraw after absorbing sorceress energy from the attacks,
they'll be immune to it next time. Laurent tapped his fingers on the table. That's only true if our sorcerers use the same dominion each time, however.
How versatile are these cinders? I recall hearing they're primarily trained in Valerian war sorcery, utilizing the dominion of flame across broad areas. He couldn't keep himself from smirking a little. If they were going to be testing him on history, he'd have to drop as many little facts like that as possible.
Actually, no. Talion frowned. You're not entirely wrong. They do focus on broad area bombardment using the Valerian school. The name Cinders doesn't come from using the Dominion of Flame, contrary to popular belief. It's just derived from the name Ember Legion. We have a broad variety of different types of sorcery at our disposal. Stone sorcery is actually the most common, followed by lightning.
Huh. The versatility of your sorcerers does them credit, Colonel. Talion pondered that for a moment. Do we know anything about the enemy sorcerers? Bringing our own sorcerers into engagement range might be dangerous if we don't know how many sorcerers they have, or how powerful they are.
Laurent gave a helpless shrug. Our best men have been trying to break through the divination shield around the city since we arrived, but we've had no success.
What about mundane scouts? Talion pointed at a lake that fed water into the city. Could we send some of our infiltrators up one of the waterways to gather some intelligence?
It's a city, not a single fortress, Revelin noted, reaching a hand up to straighten his hair. They could have sorcerers dispersed throughout the entire area. We can't know for certain until we attack, and our sorcerers have the longest range, so they offer the lowest risk.
Excellent points. Maybe they're supposed to be right about this part of the strategy, and the key is that I'm supposed to know when not to argue. He argued anyway. What about sending in some infiltrators during daylight, while we still have some time, with the intent of capturing an enemy officer, or even just a single enemy sorcerer? Either could potentially provide us with useful information. The three officers glanced at each other, but Revelin shook his head.
I don't like the odds of a group of our scouts being able to get in there and get out before nightfall. An infiltration during daylight hours wouldn't be easy.
Talion turned to Laurent. Do you have any sight sorcerers by any chance?
Laurent nodded. Of course. We have the largest collection of sorcerers here on the continent.
What did you have in mind?
Even in daylight, a small team accompanied by a sight sorcerer could most likely get inside the city. Do we know where any key points in the city are located? Their central government building, perhaps, or their military headquarters? The officers shook their heads.
No, the city has been significantly renovated since the last time we attacked. We don't even know where they're keeping the prince.
There's that mention of the prince again. I'm clearly supposed to know who that is, but why? Maybe I'm being too stubborn about asking.
What can you tell me about the prince's situation?
He was purposefully vague, since he didn't want to openly display his complete ignorance.
Prince Adelin is the foundation of our alliance. If he dies, everything we've worked for could fall apart, Morningway offered. His capture was a tremendous blow to morale, but it also served to unite us like never before. Velthrin forces, Belir's Ember Legion, and even Valeria working together. It's unprecedented. But his death could splinter this frail alliance before it firmly takes root.
Prince Adelin? I've been looking at this whole scenario the wrong way. This isn't the siege of Zixis. This is an attack on Orlan, the same city I just returned from. And it's an attack that's destined to fail.
The swordsman bit his lip. Prince Adelin had thrown himself from the tower chamber he had been locked away in. The attempt at escape had been a futile gesture. The water below his tower was just painted tiles, and he had died from the impact. The whole setup of his prison tower had been a cruel joke, a room fit for a prince that he had been unable to reach while he had been chained to the wall. Talion knew this well because he had been imprisoned in the same chamber hundreds of years after Adelin's death. While this assault on the city would fail and Adelin would die, the city would be successfully claimed by human armies many years in the future, and humans would prove to have just as depraved senses of humor as the Asharan had.
I might know where the prince is being held, Talion offered, his mind swimming with new information.
Oh? And how is that?
Revelin tilted his head to the side, looking more curious than imposing this time.
I'm pretty sure telling them that I've been sent back in time is out of the question. Not only does even the most elementary education in sorcerer's theory indicate that time sorcery of that nature is impossible, it would sound rather absurd.
This is their palace, correct?
Talion pointed at a large building on the south side of the city. He hadn't recognized Orlan previously because of the massive renovations that had occurred in the intervening centuries. Even the walls were in different locations. But the place he knew as the Low Palace was still in the same location relative where Lake Evershine flowed into the city.
Answering questions with questions is a tried-and-true tactic, Talion assured himself.
Yes, we believe so, Morningway offered, leaning her elbows on the table. Why would the prince be there?
Well, from what little I was told before being sent here, the message sent upon the prince's capture indicated he would be treated with all of the accoutrements deserved of a prince, or something along those lines. Korvax, the local ruler, is known for his twisted sense of humor. Rather than keeping Prince Adelin in a prison, why not keep him right inside the palace?
It's possible, Revelin admitted in a drawn-out tone, but guesswork at best. And the palace will be better defended than any other location in this city, even if we think he's in there. What does that gain us? We'd still have to take the entire city to have a chance at cracking the palace open.
Not necessarily. Talion folded his hands together, finally feeling like a plan was coming together. The hardest part is getting inside the city itself. Even the waterways are likely to be guarded. Talion glanced around the room. Has this chamber been thoroughly checked for any sort of divination?
Laurent nodded. Yes, we've already taken that precaution. What's your plan?
Send them another messenger. I want to challenge their leader to a duel.
After several minutes of waiting, a scout reported that Talion's challenge had been accepted. The officers had been skeptical about the duel idea, but the other elements of his plan had convinced them to make the attempt. If he failed, the bombardment of the city would begin at nightfall, just as the officers had initially planned. Talion had taken the last few minutes to suggest some rearrangements of the troops, but he suspected that the minute details wouldn't matter. He was gambling nearly everything on this infiltration plan.
I wish I knew if Prince Adelin's death had already occurred at this point in history. If he's already dead, this whole strategy might be a waste. A potential hit to enemy morale, certainly, but not enough to turn the tide. Maybe this whole scenario was intended for me to recognize an impossible fight and withdraw. But I'd rather turn an impossible fight into a possible one.
The scout escorted Talion into the next room a few minutes later. The new chamber was largely unadorned, with several people standing around and talking in hushed tones. The immersion of the scenario was temporarily broken, as Talion saw several people sitting at a table in paladin garb, a few of them marked with officer signets, toward the back of the room.
The judges, Talion guessed. Am I already done?
Wait here, the man dressed as a scout said. We'll need to prepare the next part of your scenario.
I suppose not, then.
Talion waited near the door for a few minutes, leaning back against the wall before Lieutenant Trace emerged from a door on the opposite side of the room.
A duel, huh? Trace offered Talion a smirk. We haven't had anyone try that in years.
Probably because it's suicide, Talion considered grimly. And because there's no chance the Asharan will deliver on the terms, even if they lose.
The duel isn't really the key part, Talion offered, feeling a bit defensive about his plan.
Oh, I know. I actually rather like your idea. I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays out.
Plays out? Are they actually going to have me duel something? They can't possibly have any Asharan costumes around here, can they?
Thanks, Talion offered, suddenly self-conscious. Another man emerged from the next room, nodded at Trace once, and then stepped back inside.
Looks like they're almost ready, Trace grinned. Huh. You look nervous. You sounded much more confident in the first part of the scenario.
Could he hear me? I didn't see him in there at all. Is that a picture frame on the table with the judges? Maybe it works like one of Jonan's mirrors. With sound, apparently.
I'm perfectly confident about my plan, Talion said, although it was a little less truthful than usual. Just fighting an actual Asharan might have been easier, although he tried not to think about what happened the last time he had encountered one. Even being observed during combat was nothing new. Testing his knowledge of history and tactics was infinitely more intimidating. He felt like the lives of thousands of soldiers were in his hands, even if they weren't real.
Right.
Trace gave him a friendly slap on the shoulder.
Okay. You're going to need to know a few things for this next part.
The paladin lieutenant straightened up, taking a more formal tone.
The next part of the scenario will take place in Orlan. You can safely assume that the other plans you set in motion are in progress, and that time will be passing while you head to the city for your duel.
So they probably won't actually be sending actors to play the infiltrators I asked for. That probably will make the logistics easier.
As for the duel, Trace continued, we have arranged for a simulated duel opponent for you. You may feel free to attack the target as if it is a real Asharan. The same is true for any other enemies that attack you in the next stage of the scenario. Before you head into the next room, you'll be given a protective barrier to prevent you from suffering any serious bodily harm. If you get hit, though, you're still going to feel it, and there's a chance of actual injuries. If we feel that you've suffered enough damage that you would actually be incapacitated, the scenario will be paused and advance as if that occurred.
The swordsman nodded. Will I arrive within the city before nightfall?
It will be 2 hours before nightfall when you arrive.
Talion tensed his jaw. That wasn't a lot of time for his plans to work. But it could offer benefits, too. If the bombardment started while he was still inside, that could offer a valuable distraction. But it could also force the Asharan to move or even execute the prince, assuming he was even alive at the outset of the scenario.
The paladin candidate tapped the sword on his belt.
If you're going to have me engage in combat with anyone, I really shouldn't be using this. It could cause significant actual collateral damage, even if you're using barriers. I tend to cut right through most protective spells.
Oh.
Trace's eyes widened, as if he was noticing this Sekes for the first time.
Oh, yes, of course. I'll need to confer with some people.
Lieutenant Trace moved over to the area that Talion had identified as the judges' table, exchanging whispered words with a few of the men and women sitting there.
Six judges, Talion noted. I would have expected seven.
Trace returned after a couple minutes looking strangely nervous. The judges had looked away from the portrait, and now they were all looking in Talion's direction.
I know this is an odd request, but would you mind drawing the sword for a moment?
They probably want to see if I can actually use it, he realized.
Not a problem. You might want to step back. Trace nodded hastily, taking several steps away. The swordsman placed his hand on the Sakess's grip, closing his eyes in concentration. The gesture was unnecessary, but he knew it lent a look of seriousness to the idea of drawing the weapon, which the paladins always seemed to consider to be a religious matter.
Release.
He commanded the scabbard, sensing it through the metal that connected the sword to the sheath's metal lining. The lining separated from the sword, allowing Talion to cleanly draw the sword from the scabbard. The simple metal sorcery trick he used to lock the blade in place had lent an air of mysticism to the weapon, and it doubled as an excellent precaution to prevent anyone else from using the sword. As the sword exited the sheath, the first five runes on the blade flared to life.
Five, he considered. That's better than usual. If I didn't know any better, I'd say it was pleased by the occasion.
Lighting each of the runes took years of practice. Each of the lit runes continuously drew away some of his strength in order to focus the destructive waves that surrounded the blade. Igniting each had proven more difficult than the last, and he had only succeeded in lighting the fifth, signifying Eritar, the god of travel, during the confrontation with Adon in Orlan. It was fitting, then, that he was displaying the same level of control when going to a simulated version of the city. When he opened his eyes, he noted that traces were closed, and several of the people in the room were kneeling.
Right, sacred weapon.
He held the sword awkwardly for a moment, and then brought it over his heart in a traditional paladin salute. Those paladins that still had their eyes open returned the salute immediately. He lowered the sword, and the paladins rose.
That was a little eerie.
Trace opened his eyes, smiled, and turned around.
Wait right there.
The swordsman frowned as a creeping numbness began to make its way across his fingers.
I'm not sure they realize how much this thing takes out of me, especially with five of the runes lit. I can't imagine how bad it's going to feel when I've mastered six or all seven of them.
His body had gradually acclimated to using the sword each time he managed to activate one of the runes, but the first time he ignited a new one was always worse than the last. He had barely remained conscious the first time he had activated that fifth rune, but he knew that was at least in part because of the injuries and fatigue he had already accumulated. The paladin lieutenant rushed into the next room, returning a few agonizing minutes later with a man in the blue and silver robes of a priest of Cytira. He looked to be about Talion's age, but he was almost painfully thin, and had a streak of gray in his otherwise well-trimmed blonde hair.
Hold that aloft, would you?
The skinny man asked.
And keep it still.
Talion frowned, acquiescing to the request.
Dominion of knowledge, evaluate the intensity of this effect.
The follower of Cytira reached forward to touch the glowing aura around Talion's sword, and the swordsman instinctively recoiled, drawing the weapon away. The priest's eyes narrowed.
You're going to burn your fingers off if you touch that. I very much doubt that. I'm well protected by a sorcerer's shield.
Didn't Lydia tell them anything about her own measurements? I suppose not. She's been pretty secretive about the details of her findings, even to me. I'm going to have to bother her more about that after this is over.
Last time I used this, I cut a couple pieces out of an artifact. I'm sure your shield is very potent, but... The thin priest shook his head.
Fine, fine. I can do it through an implement.
The shorter man reached into a pouch, retrieving a small metallic rod.
Now don't interrupt me this time.
Talion resisted the urge to roll his eyes. He was pretty certain he knew how this was going to end.
Dominion of knowledge, I invoke you to extend my senses into this wand.
Talion raised an eyebrow appreciatively. He hadn't heard that spell before, but it sounded useful. He already was capable of extending his detection of metal through metallic objects he was holding, but this sounded like a much more general version of that. Unfortunately, He had proven useless at attempting to cast knowledge sorcery, but maybe Lydia could make some use of the spell if she didn't already know it. Realizing he was still holding the sword,